This is News in No Time. Ed Gordon on today's roundtable. The fallout from the Jack Abramoff corruption scandal continues. And should a Martin Luther King Day parade be rescheduled because of cold weather? Joining us to discuss these topics from WFDB at Wake Forest University, Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest and a columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal. Joining us from Washington, D.C., Yvonne Bino, co-founder of the Urban Think Tank and author of the book Stand and Deliver, Political Activism, Leadership, and the Hip-Hop Culture. And joining me today in the New York Bureau, George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service. All right, folks, I wasn't going to get into this because I thought that we would be kind of alitoed out after our first segment there, but it raised an interesting question as I listened to a George Curry, and that's one of the things that I think we have to be very careful of and keep a very careful watch. When the professor talked about, and Mr. Clegg talked about, the idea of the history of Alito and, quote, civil rights, you've got to be careful when you talk about civil rights and then the individual issues of civil rights that fall under that umbrella, i.e. affirmative action and things like that. No one's going to say they're against civil rights, but one can be for civil rights, quote, and against affirmative action.
Actually, more clever than that, Ed. Title VII, which is the employment provision of the Civil Rights Act of 64, we have very clear where Alito had narrowly interpreted it. In fact, it got so bad at one point on a sex discrimination case, there are 11 appeals court judges, 10 to 1, and he's at 1 in dissent. And you find that time after time on cases where civil rights do come up that you can clearly say he's not just to the right. He's to the right of judges appointed by Reagan and Bush, and he's out of the mainstream. Mm-hmm. He does have that record.
Nat Irvin, let me turn to you.
Well, you know, I was going to say that following what George just said, and I think the opening discussion between the two and protagonists, antagonists, illustrates the difficulty I think that Judge Alito will have in this confirmation hearing. I mean, had this happened in November, had the hearings been held, I think it might have sailed through smoothly. But now I think that in addition to the points, the issues that the civil rights community are raising, which I think are quite legitimate, there's going to be a broader discussion now about this this nominee's opinions on the issue of the executive privilege. I mean, in recent, you know, we now know that the NSA has been spying on Americans at the request of the Bush administration without a warrant. I think more people are going to now be interested in wanting to know, well, what just exactly are Judge Alito's views on this issue? Does he think, for example, that the executive branch should be able to, in quote, even in wartime, should we be able to, the government be able to spy on Americans without a warrant? So my point would be this, to say not only will the civil rights, is the civil rights community and those who favor abortion are concerned, but I think now that this nomination is going to draw in even others who are more concerned about civil liberties in the larger context of American life.
Yvonne, are you surprised at, I don't know, the disconnect, if you will, that so many people seemingly have with all that is going on? I mean, we are starting to see the giants awake. By that, I mean the civil rights organizations and the others really standing up. The CBC has been loud of late, and we're going to, as I say, hear from Mark Morial and Bruce Gordon in just a few moments. They, too, have spoken out. But in general, the community, quote, unquote, monolithically speaking, has been fairly quiet about this.
Well, I don't think it's just the quote-unquote community. I think it's Americans in general. Unfortunately, we're not particularly well-versed in how the government works. I think as the as George and Nat have already said, there are a lot of issues on the table. When you look at Judge Alito's record, you know, we talk about not just when these people keep throwing out, well, I'm an advocate. I was working for such and such administration. Well, when you decide to sign on to someone's administration, just as you sign on to any other corporation, you are signing on to their policies. And not only did Judge Alito talk about that there was no right to abortion during his tenure in government, he was writing memos to think about ways to overthrow it. We start talking about presidential powers. He's advocating an expansion of presidential powers and diminution of congressional powers. That's the whole check and balance that we've always had. As George already talked about, domestic spying. We didn't even know this was going on. The vast majority of Americans didn't even know this was happening. These are warrantless spying operations. So I think there's a lot on the table, but I want to go back to this thing about civil rights laws, which I think was interesting. interesting. Mr. Clegg talked about, well, do civil rights laws protect everyone? Well, if we go back to the history of civil rights laws, they were enacted to protect particular groups, be it racial groups, gender, age, people with disabilities. So to start glossing over the reason why these laws even existed is disingenuous. I think that if you want to have a new conversation about whether or not they are still needed, that's a different discussion. But to make it seem like, well, these laws are for everybody and we don't need them as a blanket statement, I just don't think that's particularly useful.
All right, let's move on, because we'll be taking a look at Samuel Alito throughout the week as the confirmation hearings really go into full bore tomorrow. We're going to just hear a lot of hot air today, quite frankly, opening statements and the like. Speaking of the idea of the American people being perhaps turned off or at least disengaged, Nat Irvin, we continue to see the fallout from the Abramoff, what people are calling scandal. Texas Congressman Tom DeLay says that he will not run for his leadership position in the House. Part of the reason, quite frankly, and I think back to Trent Lott, when you start to see your allies fall away and suggest that they're not going to hunker down with you, that kind of gives you an idea of the fight that you have on board. And we're seeing this group of staunch Republicans who loved Tom DeLay, the hammer, they are stepping away from him, you know, quite frankly, in droves.
Well, you know you're in trouble when Newt Gingrich says you need to go. I think that Tom DeLay is actually, the circumstances, I think, where he finds himself or remind me of what happened to Jim Wright. It may be that the times have changed substantially in Washington, at least to some extent. It doesn't necessarily mean that Democrats are going to win. I don't want to go that far. But times have changed, and the Republican Party finds itself looking for a few new voices. I think Tom Hammer DeLay may have swung his last big ball-peen hammer. Not only he may very well win his case the court battle that he's faced with, but there are a couple of others running for his seat, a couple of Republicans and one Democrat vying for his seat in Texas, and he may not even win re-election. I'm not going to say that he won't, but still, he is being challenged by some moderate, different kinds of Republicans who think that maybe that there's a time for a new voice. We've got fiscal problems that the Republicans have that certainly DeLay has been a part of, that the government has not faced up to. We've got difficult issues to face that are facing us with immigration. You know, the list goes on and on, and he may be. This may be a time, DeLay may be one of those whose time has come and gone.
I don't think it's just a matter of them all of a sudden saying we need a new face and a new voice, Nat. I think it's that here he is, they got caught up in this scandal, Slime Incorporated, that's all over the place, and they don't want to get stuck by it. I mean, that's what's happening. And then you go back and you look at DeLay when he had ethics violations earlier, what the party supported him in doing was getting rid of the person who brought the charges. And this has been the pattern, and it's catching up with him.
Yeah.
Yvonne, the idea of, again, the money trail leading from Abramoff to DeLay's circle. We don't want to say it touches DeLay quite yet, right. But one has to believe. Let me say this. Let me be careful. One would find it hard to believe that DeLay didn't understand what was going on.
He went on the trips with him. He praised
exactly
him.
Hard to believe.
It's not his circle. That's him.
But I spoke of this last week, the idea that the American public understands, even if it's just the surface understanding, a cursory understanding of the way lobbying goes on. Someone said to me over the weekend, the idea of when you look at the rules and regulations over this, it's tantamount to just discerning whether it's illegal bribery or legal bribery. Don't we really have to at some point start to stand up and look at the system in and of itself?
Certainly, we should look at the system, but I think the reality is it's not going to happen. I mean, at this point, lobbying is a big business. Here in Washington, D.C., you can stumble over a lobbyist the same way you can stumble over lawyers, and it's a revolving door. For something to substantially happen that's going to make a difference, the legislators themselves will have to decide, well, we're going to have to put laws in place that would limit the ability first of aides and themselves to be able to run and be lobbyists when their term is up. I mean, those are lucrative positions, and I just don't think, frankly, that a lot of these legislators are going to make that hard call. I think also, too, when you start looking at the money, I don't think most Americans do know how much money is really involved in these lobbying schemes. Certainly, we're not talking about $50 dinners or $50 gifts. We're talking about some real high-end trips. We're talking about your spouses getting jobs. We're talking about your former aides getting jobs. We're talking about the buying and selling of access. And for a lot of these people, they're coming to Washington, D.C. Certainly, perhaps they come with great intentions, but they get caught up in this whole idea about I have to raise money to keep my seat. And that raising money overshadows to some degree what they should be doing for the people's business. So I think that it would have to be a whole lot of changes in different areas, including campaign financing, these lobbying rules, and a host of other things for anything to really change. We'll see some drips and drab changes behind this. But again, it's always every couple of years, there's a cycle of another new scandal.
All right, Nat, real quick for me.
Well, I think Yvonne sums it all up. I don't expect any major changes. I expect a lot of hullabaloo, gnashing of teeth, and swearing they'll never do it again. But this is an integral part of the American political system, and it is going to take a long time for us to be able to balance access to politicians and resulting in good public policy. This is a struggle that we're going to have to deal with for as long as I can see.
George, here's an interesting headline coming out of the nation's capital, and one that really is something that we've, again, been speaking on this program over the course of the last few months, and that is whether or not we as a community, African Americans, have been doing a good job upholding not only venerable institutions within our community, but in this sense, an annual salute. This comes out of Washington, D.C., that the organizers of the annual MLK parade want to move it from January to April because of inclement weather in January, the idea that it's difficult to hold a parade in the winter. But of course, this was the month that the man was born, and that's why they wanted to make the salute. The other concern was raised by others. Initially, they looked at the first Saturday in April in terms of the move date. That, in fact, would be April Fool's Day, and people were irked by that. And then the question of, and we should note they picked April because that is the month he was assassinated. What of the idea that even if you wanted to push for the idea that, you know, it doesn't matter if it's cold, a salute is a salute, and for all of what he did and others during that era, you should be willing to stand in the cold? Or does it just make sense because it's frigid to move it?
And it's not all that cold in D.C. I've lived in D.C. twice and New York twice, and D.C. doesn't come close to New York in terms of cold. You know, you do go, and Joe Lauer said we shouldn't elect civil rights leaders unless they were born in the summer, and we can celebrate that way. But you celebrate on a person born, not when a person dies. I mean, that you look at all the presidential celebration we have. You hear the controversial Malcolm X, they want to move it from when he was assassinated to when he was actually born. That's when you celebrate. You have no control over that, and I don't think that should be a major issue. You celebrate when you're supposed to celebrate it and not try to find some convenient way of doing it, which is a stupid, in this case, not even check the calendar to find out it's April Fool's Day. And they did move it back another week.
I think it's clearly, this is one of those things that just drives me crazy, and it illustrates how there's so much symbolism over substance. I mean, you know, Marion Barry was just robbed the other day in Washington, D.C. Last time I checked, the public schools in D.C. were failing. I mean, there's so many important issues that black people have to deal with, and here we are arguing over the weather in January as opposed to April. Look, it can rain. You can have a hurricane in April. But the fact is, a parade is a parade. Dr. King's legacy should not be tied to just a parade. It should be tied much more toward the actions, individual actions that people do themselves to create a more caring and just society. A parade is a parade. I can't imagine why it should take so much energy to decide whether to move it to January or to April, or unless we want to say, of course, we have finally overcome to the extent that now we can just debate about whether it's too cold to literally march. If you were marching for something, you know, if indeed people were marching for an idea behind some civil action, how could it matter whether it's in January or in April?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that we get really caught up in the hype of symbols, and we're less ardent when it comes to taking substantive action. If we look at Southeast Washington, D.C., which is Ward 8, where the parade would start, I mean, it has the highest percentage of families living in poverty, the highest high school dropout rates, high substance abuse and HIV positive infection rates. So, I mean, to me, the whole idea of blowing off all this steam about whether or not to honor Dr. King in January or April does not even do justice to his memory when we are not really dealing with those key issues that are affecting people day in and day out. So for me, this is a lot of politicians doing what they do, evading the real issues at hand and drawing attention to things as a diversion.
I bet you there are far more people right now in Washington, D.C., who cannot afford to stay warm in January, who literally can't heat their homes. And here we are talking about whether or not you can go outside in a parade. Give me a break.
Well, just don't put them over the Macy Day Parade in New York. Well, they won't do that in Thanksgiving. They'll do that in June.
Well, give me a break, somebody.
But it's the grandstanding, and you know, we get caught up in all these other things. Like a couple of years ago, that we were talking about blacks on television. We got all hyped up about that. Now we're talking about parades. We're always marching, but we never get anywhere.
Let me say this in the words of Roy Jones, the fine boxer and pugilist, poet and rapper. You must have forgot. Because, Nat, we do talk about heating oil and heating homes in the winter for poor folk on this program as well. So I don't want you to think we have
done
that.
No, not in April.
All right. Nat, George Yvonne, thank you so very much. Greatly appreciate it.